Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, we talked to key figures in the middle of really big negotiations that affect all of our lives. The California budget, over $200 billion being negotiated. We talk with the Speaker of the California Assembly, Anthony Rendon. This transportation bill, over $2 trillion. We talk with the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. And we get into the 2020 race with some extraordinary reporting. This new book, Battle for the Soul, which has gotten all sorts of buzz. The author of it is Edward Isaac Dover of The Atlantic, previously of Politico, one of the top political reporters in the whole country. He's going to be with us a little bit later. But let's begin with the Speaker of the Assembly, Anthony Rendon. The bill or the budget due next week here in California. He's negotiating the deal with Governor Newsom, and he starts us off.
Speaker Rendon, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Good to see you, Alex. Good to be back.
All right. So where are we at in the negotiations, and what's the biggest sticking point at this point?
We're in the home stretch, really. We're about a week out from having a finalized budget. In terms of sticking points, I think it's really about fine-tuning things. We have more revenue than we thought we'd have. We have a dynamic and responsible budget, has more money set aside for in our rainy day fund than ever before. So we're excited about moving forward with the outline that we have and talking to the governor to get his input.
Is it a lot more fun doing this when you have that big of a surplus?
It's a lot more fun when you have more money to spend. There, you know, probably it sometimes takes a little bit more work. But yeah, I mean, we're looking at a situation as recently as September where we thought that we would be in the red this year. To have this surplus is incredible. It's fantastic.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues. Homelessness, issue number one for so many people. You're proposing historic spending on homelessness. In the simplest terms, what is your plan to deal with this?
Our plan is to make sure that local entities, whether it's city governments or counties, have the resources that they need to address issues in their own communities. They're the ones who know problem areas and how to get people housed. So as you said, we're giving more money. We're spending more money on homelessness than we've ever spent. We also know we have a problem with housing scarcity. So we're going to do all we can and make sure that there's more housing online so that we can impact the law of supply and demand and help to bring down some of the prices of housing.
All right, let's talk about another issue. There's been a bit of a disagreement between the legislature and the governor over expanding medical insurance for undocumented Californians. Your plan includes health care for low-income undocumented Californians who are over 50. The governor's is over 60. So where are we looking at settling on this?
Well, we want to get to 50. We think that's sort of an important marker in terms of the demographics. We've kind of looked at the bell curve and where most people fall. These are people who are in this country contributing to our economy. We want to make sure they're healthy. We want to make sure that a lot of the health maladies that they sometimes suffer from, including COVID, where this population suffered tremendously, we want to make sure that they get the coverage that they need. That being said, you know, we're talking to the governor and the administration about these issues every day.
So you don't have a deal yet on that?
No, definitely don't have a deal on that yet, but we anticipate having one by the 15th.
And for people that say, look, we have a hard enough time taking care of people that are citizens in this country, we shouldn't be spending money on this, what do you say to them?
I'd say regardless of your feelings about the presence of these folks in this country, in this state, they're here. They're contributing to our economy. They're folks who are working at the restaurants you eat at the stores you purchase from. And we want them to be healthy.
On last week's show, we talked with Caitlyn Jenner. It got more reaction than anything we've ever done on the show. I asked her about the size of the budget, which is what you do for a living. She said she didn't know what it was. When I asked her about cutting taxes, here's what she said. Do you think that taxes on the rich should be lowered in California?
I think it's an issue. I haven't gotten strongly into exactly what we're going to have.
So what do you make of her?
Don't know her. And unfortunately, we were dealing with one of our deadlines last week, so I haven't caught the interview yet, Alex. I promise I will catch it. I'm interested in your reaction to having interviewed her. I don't know Caitlyn Jenner. I think if somebody's going to run for governor of California and help to be part of the team that the governance team for the state, I think they ought to have well articulated ideas about policies like taxation.
And I want to say a programming note next week on the issue is former San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner will be in studio to talk about his plan to run California. We have a lot of different perspectives on this show, and he will be sharing his view. But before we go, and before we let you go for this week, we want to play personal issues with you, Mr. Speaker. This is where we put 30 seconds on the clock. We ask rapid-fire questions. And since we're fully reopening on Tuesday, this is a lot about your post-June 15th plan. So are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. So let's put that 30 seconds up, and here we go. The thing you are most excited to do first?
Eat Korean barbecue.
Where?
Anywhere in K-Town.
Okay. Sports team you most want to see in person first?
Oh, the Dodgers. We've talked about this for sure.
Concert you most want to go to?
There's a band I've been listening to. They're an LA band, Lord Huron. They're kind of a local hipster band. They're great live. I'd like to see them again.
And a favorite book you read in quarantine?
I read a lot. Probably DJ Waldie's book, Becoming Los Angeles. Fantastic, fantastic read.
Would you describe yourself as a local hipster?
No, I'm too old to be a hipster.
All right. Well, we appreciate you getting into that kind of music.
Our thanks to Speaker Rendon. And now we dig into the issue of infrastructure with one of the key figures negotiating the infrastructure deal, and one of our most frequent guests here, the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg.
We've reached the point where we need to pursue multiple pathways to get this done.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is a key player in the room for negotiations over President Biden's more than $2 trillion infrastructure bill. This week, the White House called off talks with Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito, but continued talks with other Republicans.
Do you think that the Republicans are negotiating in good faith, or do you think they're just trying to run out the clock?
You know, there's been a lot of goodwill in honest, frank negotiations where sometimes we turn out just to be too far apart. And so that's what happened with the group that the president was speaking with earlier. There are other groups forming, different combinations of Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate. And it's absolutely worth pursuing that track.
The White House says California's infrastructure gets a C-minus grade and has more than 1,500 bridges and 14,000 miles of road that are poor quality.
California, you got it all, right? You got ports and airports, you got waterfront and desert, you got roads and rail and transit and everything in between, rural and urban. And it's exactly why we need a plan like this that doesn't nibble around the edges.
I asked about California's struggle to build high-speed rail on budget and on time.
What do you say to people who don't necessarily trust that the government does this well?
America doesn't have a lot of batting practice when it comes to true high-speed rail, and California has stepped forward to be one of the first places doing it in full in the U.S., and that's had a lot of challenges. But what we can't do is somehow accept the idea that America should settle for less. The president believes America should be number one in the world.
We also talked about the Biden administration's push to vaccinate Americans via record incentives. Budweiser offering free beer. United, free flights. Microsoft, free Xboxes. And California, $1.5 million.
We know that you are already vaccinated, but if you weren't already vaccinated, what would be the prize that would excite you the most?
Well, the free beer sounds pretty good to me. So I guess a little easier to win me over than a $1 million lottery.
Apparently, you're a cheap date, which sounds good.
Maybe I'm not such a good negotiator. I could have had $1 million and you had me a beer.
Congratulations, Mr. Secretary. Congratulations.
So Buttigieg is one of America's first openly gay cabinet secretaries, now serving during LGBTQ Pride Month.
What does pride mean to you?
Well, you know, right now I'm thinking about the journey we've been on. You know, not that long ago, somebody who was out would have been unimaginable as a cabinet officer or, you know, even as a federal employee. We got a long way to go, but what pride means to me is that there really is a chance to stand up for each other in the name of compassion, in the name of equality, and make life better. And my being here is one small piece of evidence of that. And I know there are a lot of young people out there wondering whether they fit. They know they're different, and they don't know whether America has a place for them. And I'm here to say that there's a lot of people rooting for you.
Our thanks to Secretary Pete. Finally, a look at an crazy election.
It is called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. It is by Edward Isaac Dover. It is one of the best-selling books in all of politics, and he joins us now. Welcome to The Issue Is for the very first time.
Thanks. First time here, but not first time I've watched, so it's great to be here.
Thank you very much. And for some background on him, by the way, he is a staff writer at The Atlantic and former senior White House correspondent at Politico and one of the best plugged-in people in all of politics. And shameless plug, I read the book. I love the book. This is one of the best books on politics in terms of taking you in the room that I've read in a really long time. So if you're into this sort of thing, highly recommend it to our audience, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. So let's start,
Thanks for saying that.
Title, Battle for the Soul. You talk about this challenge between moderates, progressives, trying to figure out where do we go? How do we fight Donald Trump? And where does the party go from here? What do you mean when you say Battle of the Soul?
It ended up being battles for the souls, almost. There's so much that went into this campaign in the end. And when I started out to write this book, it was in 2018. I thought it was going to be the craziest election, maybe the most important election in American history. I had no sense that the pandemic was coming, the economic crisis, the rethinking of work and school, the rethinking of everything in our society. I didn't know that George Floyd was going to be killed in that way. I didn't know that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was going to die. All of these things that set off major changes in America and that made it so that when America voted last year for president, they were making a really big decision, the voters. But I would say one of the things that sets this book apart, it is not another Trump book. There are a lot of Trump books out there. This is covering things that you haven't seen elsewhere and haven't read about elsewhere.
Well, and one of those things, or a lot of those things, involve former President Barack Obama. And one of the things that I didn't know was that his first choice for president was not Joe Biden, and it's not somebody a lot of people think of.
And there's a scene in the book in the end of 2017 where he playing a game, and he says to some of his aides, who do you want in your head, who do you want in your heart, and who do you think can win? And in his heart, he says Biden. But in his head, he says Bill McRaven, the commander of the Navy SEAL raid that killed bin Laden, which was he wasn't the only one thinking that. I had heard other people saying, hey, maybe that's the statesman choice to come out of the Trump years. That's what we need to do. But then when he got to the question of who could win, he said, I don't know.
And he had some choice language that we see in the book that we have not seen publicly, some of the ways he described Donald Trump.
Yeah, and look, as a reporter, as you know, if you can ever find an example of a politician cursing, it's great because you know that you're getting the unvarnished, raw feeling of what happened. So when he is watching, for example, news reports that Donald Trump is talking to foreign leaders without aides on the phone, has the Russian ambassador into the Oval Office without anybody else in there. The way that it comes at him at one point is that corrupt MF-er, but he doesn't say MF-er, he says the full word. I won't subject myself to the bleeping. And that's how frustrated he was by what was happening.
We need an HBO version just to do this book justice, because there are a lot of people that curse throughout it. And speaking of that, there's a scene of Kamala Harris talking about her role as a prosecutor in California with some more choice language.
Yeah, this is a scene that it goes to the meeting that she had with her staff at her sister's apartment building in New York City, actually, in the summer of 2018, when they were deciding, is she going to run for president? And her brother-in-law, Tony West, her sister Maya's husband, goes after her with everything that he can think of to go to bring up that would be a problem for her. And key to that is criticizing her record as a prosecutor from when she was in San Francisco and even when she was AG, saying you betrayed Black people, you did all these things that were so terrible, you put a lot of people in jail, and really trying to go after her as hard as he can imagine someone would on the campaign trail. And Harris looked at it, and at that point, she responds, she sort of cocks her head like this, is the way it's been described to me, and she says, yeah, I locked some MFers up. But again, she uses the full word. When she says it, I don't think most people know this, she's actually very deliberate, and she'll correct people's pronunciation of that full word if they say it with the R's. She likes to end with the so the viewers can put together what I'm saying.
Well, let's get into the Biden-Harris relationship. We were just looking at some clips of that debate. And another swear word, I guess, is Joe Biden. After that moment where Kamala Harris basically attacks him over busing, he turned to Pete Buttigieg and described the scene, and it also sort of changed the relationship between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for a while.
You're going to make everybody think that it's all curse words, but they're 500 pages of material. Yeah. This is another one of those moments, right? Because what happens is she says a phrase that had been worked out by her campaign, which is, I know you're not a racist. And the attack overall really lights Biden up. He turns to Pete Buttigieg, whom at that point he didn't know at all. And as they go into the commercial break, and he says, oh, that was some effing BS. Again, not the full words. And then it carries forward. They were so angry about it, the Biden folks. And then there's a phone call that's reported in the book of Jill Biden talking to some donors and supporters. And she is so angry about it. And she says, to stand up there and call him a racist with everything that he's done, the life that he's led, the work that he's put in, go F yourself.
So I
should say they've worked it out.
Clearly, she's now the vice president of the United States and a pretty visible vice president of the United States. We are back with the author of Battle for the Soul, an extraordinary book about democratic politics, Edward Isaac Dover. You had a real exclusive, which is the first interview with Joe Biden in the Oval Office as president. What was that experience like, and where would you describe his mindset right now?
Okay, so I should say he was in the Oval Office. It was the very beginning of February. So I was over the phone, and I want to misrepresent what happened because of the COVID restrictions still. I think what you see out of Biden now as president is a level of control of himself. There aren't a lot of moments where he's like blabbing and saying things, going off script, in part because his staff has kept him very much on the ball and not doing a lot of just freewheeling moments. And in part because there's a sense of confidence that is coming off of him that I could feel in that interview and that other people that I've talked to have said to me they felt as well. This is a man who literally for longer than I've been alive has been thinking about running for president. He got to be president despite a lot of people doubting that he could. Right. And when we were talking at one point, he pointed to the painting of FDR that he had hanging over the fireplace in the Oval Office, that prime spot. That's the North Star that he's using now. It's not just small ball business that he's interested in.
And I know as journalists, you're never supposed to make predictions, and people that have usually get in trouble. But if you had to bet, would you bet that he runs again?
It's a really hard thing to say. He says he's going to run. He would be 82 at that point. He would be the oldest president to run for reelection. He was already the oldest president to be elected. Talk to people close to him, and they say he is running.
Yeah,
for sure. But, you know, a lot of things change, and who knows? Well, Lyndon Johnson was running for president in 1968 until he wasn't, right?
Yeah. That is a better political answer than most of the politicians give. So I like that you gave yourself a lot of wiggle room there. All right, we play games on this show. This one's kind of fun.
Right.
It's called the Name Game. It's going to get to the heart of the key players in the 2020 race. One word that comes to mind to describe each of them. All right. Let's start with Joe Biden.
Deep feeling. That's sort of hyphenated.
Kamala Harris.
Determined.
Bernie Sanders.
Committed.
Elizabeth Warren.
That's a tough one. Cerebral.
Pete Buttigieg.
Analytic.
Cory Booker.
Emotional.
Andrew Yang.
Curious.
And we'll see if mayor is going to be the word to describe him soon.
Yes.
Our thanks to Edward Isaac Dover. Our thanks to all of our guests this week. Our thanks to you for listening. I'm Alex Michelson. Hope you'll connect with me in social media at Alex Michelson. Like, subscribe to this podcast. Tell your friends about it as well. And join us on TV as well. We'll see you next week. We've got Mayor Kevin Faulkner, one of the candidates for governor of California, joining us next week. Hope you'll come back for that. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.